Patrick Humphreys is an English journalist with many books about musicians to his credit, including books about Bruce Springsteen and Paul Simon, and he's working currently on a book about Tom Waits. Patrick, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
You mentioned that you discovered Paul Simon, as it were, in about 1966. What about your own personal discovery? When did you come across his music? How old were you? That sort of thing.
I would have been about 13 or 14, so just the right age for those songs about alienation and isolation and Nobody Understands Me, which was very much his forte at the time. I remember being very impressed with the Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme album when that came out. It seemed to be very elaborate, beautifully produced, quite baroque. It seemed to have real depth and substance to it, which even the Beatles and Bob Dylan were struggling to match at the time. And I've just really followed his career ever since. Heartbroken when Simon and Garfunkel broke up. But very keen to follow his music ever since. Fascinating journey for 40 years, really. Well, I suppose if you take into account the Tom and Jerry period, which is often forgotten about, quite often by Simon himself, it's a career that's been going on for half a century.
Based on your research, let's talk about why Paul went to England in, I think, 1964, with an intent to stay, it seems. What was so appealing about living in England to him?
Well, you've got to remember it's swinging London back in 1964 when Paul Simon first arrived in Britain. The Beatles had just come back from conquering America. London was incredibly fashionable after years of... in the immediate years following the Second World War, when the city was very badly blitzed, when I grew up in it. I mean, it was very grey. It was a very black and white world. I mean, when I was born in 1952, there was still food rationing. So, I mean, it was very... the shadow of the war hung heavy over the country. And then in the early 60s, there seemed to be this colourful explosion. I mean, you think of the 60s and it was... You think of it in colour. It goes from black and white into colour. And Paul Simon arrived here. He'd had a spectacularly... Well, no, he's... Paul Simon arrived here in 1964. He's in his mid-20s. He'd already been a pop singer, a teen idol, with Art Garfunkel as Tom and Jerry. They had their one hit in 1957 with Hey Schoolgirl. And he felt, I think, that perhaps his later songs would be better appreciated in the UK. I think one reason why he came here, apart from the appeal of swinging London, was that in America at the time, the Dylan cast this enormous shadow over the contemporary music scene. And I think every singer-songwriter, everybody who picked up a guitar and had something more to say than Itsy Bitsy Teensy Weensy Yellow Polka Dot Bikini was immediately compared to Bob Dylan. And I think Simon felt that perhaps if he got further away from New York, there's a chance that he might escape that comparison and he might be seen as something rather exotic, which he certainly wasn't at home in New York.
Right. And you've talked with a lot of people who did cross paths with Paul Simon in those days in England. How do they describe Paul Simon in performance or on the scene back then?
Well, over the years, I've spoken to a lot of people who remember seeing Paul Simon appearing at the folk clubs in and around London and across the United Kingdom during 1964 and 1965. And it's very interesting. I mean, a lot were really impressed with him, really blown away by the intensity of his performance, of his guitar playing, of the songs, which formed the foundation for the Simon and Garfunkel career. At the time, hearing him play them solo in a folk club when you paid, you know, 7 and 6, which is what... 35p, which is, you know, less than nothing, to see Paul Simon do these songs. It was a very powerful experience and really left its mark on people who witnessed them at the time. But there were also people who found him very arrogant, who found one abiding criticism was that the folk scene in Britain at the time was quite endearingly amateurish. It was quite shambolic. It was people sang these songs that were stretched back for hundreds of years. It was very doctrinaire. And this young, cocky American came over singing his own songs and very much putting on a professional show. I mean, he'd do the patter between the songs. He'd talk about the records he'd had out. And of course, at the time, the folk scene, the British folkies, were very much quite proud of their amateur appeal. So one abiding memory that people have of him when he came over here in the mid-60s was that rather slick professionalism when it came to performing. But equally, many were folks called Harvey Andrews remembers just being completely knocked out by hearing Sounds of Silence for the first time and these early classic songs. And if you think about it, it must have been quite a thing. I mean, to go into a smoky room over a pub in Liverpool or Birmingham or Exeter or somewhere on the outskirts of London and see this short, young man in a sort of existential black polo neck sweater with his guitar singing these incredible songs live, accompanying himself on guitar. It must have been quite a night out.
Right, and very different from what was on the pop charts in the UK or the United States then, as the first wave of Beatlemania was sweeping the popular consciousness. There was sort of a counterpoint in a way, wasn't it?
Very much so, yes. I mean, the pop scene at the time Paul Simon arrived in London was, the Beatles were all conquering. I mean, they'd just come back from America. I think there was an incredible, they had something like 15 records in the Hot 100. I mean, they really had conquered America. The Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds, the Animals. I mean, there was some great music around at the time. People are always banging on about how great the 60s were, and it must be very boring if you didn't live through it. But, I mean, turning on the radio and hearing House of the Rising Sun by the Animals or Satisfaction by the Stones or Jimi Hendrix, Procol Harum, whatever the Beatles were doing next. So it was a very exciting time. But it was very pop music by and large. I mean, the only outlet for it was on the BBC Light programme, and they were very strict about what they played, which was largely middle-of-the-road, easy-listening type music. The Beatles had a good relationship with them. You couldn't ignore them. But it was quite difficult to hear the new and exciting music. The pirate radio stations were playing it on ships in the North Sea. But to hear somebody like Paul Simon play these songs that lyrically had so much to say, that would have been quite an experience.
He recorded the Paul Simon Songbook in England, is that right?
Yes. In about the middle of 1965, Paul Simon came to London and recorded his first solo album, which was released, the Paul Simon Songbook, which came out later that year. It was really pretty much the repertoire he'd have been doing in the folk clubs at the time. You wouldn't have Homeward Bound on it because that famously hadn't been written yet, but it was the foundation of the Simon and Garfunkel repertoire for many years to come. I mean, it was what became hit singles, The Sounds of Silence, I'm a Rock. There were songs that would appear on later Simon and Garfunkel albums like Leaves of the Green and April Comes She Will, He Was My Brother. I mean, they were good, solid songs. And these were the songs that he would have, if you paid your money to see him in a folk club in the UK in the mid-60s, this would have been pretty much his repertoire.
Mm-hmm. And among those, if you recall them, or I suppose I could refresh your memory. It sounds like you've got it in there. What's a song or two that do appear to be standouts in the way they were performed on the songbook?
Well, the Paul Simon Songbook is one of my favorite albums of his because it is just it's a Polaroid. It's just a snapshot of this very talented young man at a very early stage of his career. I mean, he hasn't become jaundiced or blasé by the success that followed. He hasn't been overwhelmed by success. The material he's performing is fresh to him. He's just written it. He's very keen to convey it. I think the version of Sounds of Silence on here is one of the best ever recorded. There's an intensity to it. He's very justifiably proud of the song, and he's really he's giving it everything he's got in this performance. There's a nice song as well called A Simple Desultory Philippic, which is a very, very intellectually rather arrogant song. But it's again, it's a nice snapshot of the people he mentions in the song are people he would have known on the folk club circuit and shared flats with. So there's a nice little sort of snapshot of that period. But also just, I mean, songs like, I mean, Kathy's song, the song to his English girlfriend, you know, you hear that on the Paul Simon songbook, and it's beautiful, just a beautiful, beautiful version of a really haunting song.
It's interesting when you characterize a song as intellectually arrogant. In this case, the artist would, from everything we've read, probably agree with you.
Paul Simon's got a very strict attitude to his early work. I mean, he regards them as juvenilia. He thinks that they're just the works of a young, up-and-coming songwriter, and he's quite reluctant to talk about them or perform them these days. But, of course, the irony is those are the songs that he's best known for. In concert, I saw him last year in London. It's the old favourites that really get the standing ovations. And when Simon & Garfunkel toured in 2003-2004, it was the Simon & Garfunkel songs that really got the crowd going. And a lot of those were written and recorded around the time he was in England in the mid-60s. And I suppose to him they're a bit of a millstone round his neck, but for his audience they're probably the defining songs for him.
You observe in one of the chapters of this book, even written then, that despite their supposed naivete in his eyes in retrospect, that the early work had huge importance at the time. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
What you mean, the Simon & Garfunkel stuff?
Yeah, I want to get into that point by point here and album by album, but I just thought in since we were talking about it, that just sort of some overall thoughts about how songs that seem to the artist to be a little bit archaic or something because he's grown past those years of his 20s, that they certainly had importance to offer the society then and the youth culture and possibly still even today.
Yeah, I think the early songs that Simon wrote that he now perhaps is a little bit embarrassed by are, I think they stand up very well. I mean, I can understand something like I'm a Rock to him as now, what is he now, mid-60s. I can imagine the lines like, you know, I have my books and my poetry to protect me. I mean, it's terribly precious and it's terribly adolescent, which I suppose is why it was so appealing at the time. I think Sounds of Silence still has some immense merit. I mean, I think it's because it's so well known, it's perhaps overlooked just what a good song it is, and just that feeling of alienation and the inability to communicate is brilliantly conveyed, you know, very economically in that song.
So if you would be willing, I'd like to step through the American release of Sounds of Silence and the next couple and just maybe have you give us a snapshot or two of songs on the album that you find intriguing.
Yeah.
And feel free to, you know, select songs that maybe aren't as popular if they call to you, beginning with the first album. It'll be the second album.
Right, Sounds of Silence album.
Right.
Right. Well, the story of Sounds of Silence becoming a hit is probably quite well known, but I mean, basically what happened, Simon & Garfunkel recorded it in 1964 for an acoustic album called Wednesday Morning 3 AM, which sold well to immediate family. I mean, the sales were, I believe, about 5,000 copies in the States. So it didn't really amount to anything. Then later in 1965, a disc jockey in a college town found that when he played the track, it was very well received by the student listeners, and contacted Columbia Records in New York. And Tom Wilson, who at the time was Bob Dylan's producer, thought there was some merit in the track, and without either Simon or Garfunkel's knowledge or permission, overdubbed electric guitar, bass, drums, and I think organ onto the acoustic Sounds of Silence and released it as a single. And this was to cash in on the folk rock boom that Bob Dylan had kick-started earlier in 1965. And to everyone's amazement, it shot up the charts and reached number one in America at the end of 1965. Now, Simon was still performing as a solo act in the folk clubs around England at the time. And it was a phone call from Garfunkel in New York saying, look, you better get back here, something's happening, you know, and he flew back to New York. Now, the plan was always, reading interviews with him and over the years, he was in love with an English girl called Kathy, who is featured on the cover of the Paul Simon songbook. And the plan was always that Simon would fly back to the States, cash in on the success of Sounds of Silence, which he'd already had some experience of doing as a one-hit wonder in the 50s, make some money out of that, and then come back to England, marry Kathy, and live happily ever after. But as you know, fate had other plans. And the whole Simon and Garfunkel, really, their career began with that version of Sounds of Silence. And the album had to be done really quickly, so the bulk of it was material that Simon had already written in England and had appeared on the Paul Simon songbook. The English elements you can pick up quite easily. There's Angie, which is a very complex guitar piece he learned from Davy Graham, who's one of the prime folk guitarists on the scene at the time. And, of course, Homeward Bound, which was famously written on Widnes Station platform. This is the legend. In fact, he'd actually begun writing it in Liverpool, and the bones of the song were there, but certainly large parts of it were fashioned on this station platform, waiting for the milk train to bring him back to London and to Kathy. So the Sounds of Silence album is not particularly representative of what they would go on to do, but again, it's a nice snapshot of Simon and Garfunkel at that period, with some very striking songs from the English period. I mean, Sounds of Silence, Homeward Bound, and Kathy's Song are particularly striking, I think.
Mm-hmm. Any of those in particular, or another one that you think is improved upon in the setting with Art Garfunkel and the production in New York?
Leaves of the Green, I think, has got a nice Simon and Garfunkel sound to it.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you just intonated, the duo really took hold, and a second album was not long down the road, Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. What are your impressions, a couple of highlights that you think tell us a little bit about Paul Simon's work from that album?
Well, the Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme album came out in 1966, at a time when, I think the caffeine overdose is kicking in. The Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme album came out in 1966 when pop was sort of becoming rock. I mean, the Beatles had stopped being sort of lovable mop tops. They were moving into the Revolver territory, which signposted Sgt. Pepper. Stones were getting more interesting on record. Dylan. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on at that time. And Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme really is the first album that Simon and Garfunkel had any control over in the studio. They really were into double tracking and really using the studio almost as another instrument. And there's some really beautiful stuff on there. One of my all-time favourite Simon and Garfunkel songs is The Dangling Conversation. I think it's a marked leap forward from that insular, rather precious stuff like I'm a Rock. I mean, I think it's a real chamber piece, and I think works remarkably well. It's one of the songs I know Simon is particularly embarrassed by now, but I think it stands out remarkably well. Art Garfunkel singing for Emily Whenever I May Find Her, just beautiful, beautiful vocal performance. Famously, Scarborough Fair is included on there. This was a traditional song that Simon heard from a British folk singer who's still very active today, Martin Carthy, and used that Martin's version of the song. He recorded it with Garfunkel in New York and then incorporated one of his own songs, a canticle section. This, of course, went on to become one of Simon and Garfunkel's most famous songs, I know at the time and for many years after, people were pretty cheesed off that it was I know at the time and long after, people were pretty fed up that it was attributed as a composition to Simon and Garfunkel, when in fact it was a traditional song. It should have been Trad R. P. Simon A. Garfunkel. I think later on they did correct it. But on the Parsi Sage, that's where the Parsi Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, the title comes from the refrain in Scarborough Fair. And of course, it's the album that includes a lot of the songs that, again, would be integral to their repertoire. I mean, Cloudy, 59th Street Bridge Song, were in the repertoire for years. And of course, it was this album that led them to do the music for The Graduate, which came out the following year.
Could you pause and just reflect a little bit more about the Dangling Conversation? Because this is a song title that does come up when people reflect fondly on the time. And as you mentioned, Paul Simon never says much nice about it. But what in the lyric or the presentation of that that you found intriguing, still find intriguing when you hear it today?
Well, I think the Dangling Conversation's got a real, it's a very fragile beauty to it. I think the harpsichord, I think the harmonising, the instrumentation, the production. It's just one of those perfect moments. I mean, you just feel you're a fly on the wall in this conversation. And I think lyrically it's a still life watercolour of the now late afternoon. I mean, you just get the impression of the sun and the curtains blowing. And, you know, it's a beautifully evocative song. And I'm surprised he's so down on it. I mean, it certainly was. I felt conspicuous by not. No, how do I say it? It was conspicuous in its absence from when they reunited a couple of years ago. And I suppose the lines about you read your Emily Dickinson, and they name check all these poets and these terribly meaningful questions. But is the theatre really dead? I mean, I suppose to them that's pretty embarrassing adolescent stuff. But I think it's compensated for by the production and the harmonies and just the sheer quality of the song.
Right, it's a bit of a time capsule, but you can imagine these conversations happening in coffee houses in New York that year.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Right.
All right, and then Bookends is a pretty mature work in a lot of ways and seems to have picked up a lot of polish or whatever, inventiveness maybe, that the Beatles helped offer up through Pepper in that period. What stands out to you about Bookends? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I did jump ahead. And in your book, you spent some time placing a good bit of weight on The Graduate and Mrs. Robinson as a key moment for Simon and Garfunkel. I think without maybe going into the story so much as to talk about, how it all happened, but a little bit about, why it was important.
Right, well, The Graduate came out in 1967, and what I think is important about it is the way that the music of Simon and Garfunkel is used on the film soundtrack. This is before Easy Rider. This was the first mainstream, big-budget Hollywood movie that incorporated rock and roll music effectively on the soundtrack. I mean, Rock Around the Clock had got audiences... Hold on a minute. Rock Around the Clock in the 50s had got audiences slashing cinema seats just to hear the song. But The Graduate was the first time that rock music had effectively been used to comment on the character's development and motivation. And my understanding is that the director, Mike Nichols, had a younger brother who kept playing Simon and Garfunkel's Parsi Sage, Rosemary and Thyme to him, and he thought they were the guys for the job to do the music. Now, the plan was always that Simon would write an original score for The Graduate, but he's a notoriously painstaking writer. He kept missing deadlines. The only new song he came up with was Mrs. Robinson, which isn't even heard in full on the soundtrack album. It's just a fragment. But what they did use was existing material from the Parsley Sage album. So you'll hear Scarborough Fair Canticle and April Comes You, a Big Bright Green Pleasure Machine, and Sounds of Silence from the Sounds of Silence album. So they really populated the soundtrack, and even, as I say, Mrs. Robinson, the best known song, doesn't actually appear until even the best known song from The Graduate, which is Mrs. Robinson, didn't appear until 1968 when it was released as a single, and appeared on the second side of the Bookends album.
Oh, and what is it about that song, Mrs. Robinson, that is so strong and compelling, particularly lyrically, with what Paul Simon is maturing into at that stage?
Well, Mrs. Robinson, what is it all about? I asked Art Garfunkel that very same question a couple of years ago, and they remastered the Simon and Garfunkel albums and put them out. I went to New York to interview him, and I said, it's what is it about? I mean, and he said, you don't ask Paul Simon what these songs are about. You're just privileged to sing them. I think the best bet is that it's reflecting on the Mrs. Robinson character in an institution of some sort. She's had some sort of breakdown, and that's what the place he decided to put her in his song. There's very much a Beatle element in there. I mean, that "Goo Goo Goo Joo," Mrs. Robinson's from "Eye on the Walrus." I think Simon's very unhappy that he couldn't come up with a better refrain. That it was sort of nonsense chorus. But it's the one that really it was the double whammy of the success of the film of The Graduate and the hit single Mrs. Robinson that really put Simon and Garfunkel into the superstar league.
You wrote rather compellingly, though, about sort of an interpretation of the final lyric, the final verse, and how he does manage to sort of turn this song ostensibly about the character in the film into takes it to a broader canvas about America in general.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the final verse, I mean, "Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio, a nation turns its lonely eyes to you." I mean, he's very, very big baseball fan all his life, Paul Simon, so any opportunity to mention baseball heroes he'll jump at. But I think it was, I mean, America, the world in 1968, you'd had the Summer of Love in 67 when it was Flowers and Peace and All You Need Is Love, and then 68 was when it toughened up, and it was a year of revolution. I mean, it was the student riots in Paris and America and London. It was the big anti-Vietnam demonstrations. It was the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. I mean, it was very bloody. It was very messy. And America really seemed to be split. There was the year of assassinations. I mean, they got Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy in 68, and with Vietnam escalating, it really seemed as though the nation was divided, and that I think Mrs. Robinson does reflect that in the final verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also in 1967 is the Monterey Pop Festival, and you spent a little time in your book reflecting on Simon's involvement in that. Would you consider his involvement in it and their performance there a major launching point of respectability for the two?
No, not really, actually. I think the Monterey Festival, I think the Monterey Pop Festival has gone down in history as the first pop festival in history. I think it is a significant event. I mean, it's when Jimi Hendrix and The Who really broke America, and incredible performance from Otis Redding and Janis Joplin and a lot of the San Francisco bands, Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. But I don't think Simon and Garfunkel were particularly well received. They were almost seen as a bit sort of old hat. Their look was very collegiate, was very clean cut in comparison to sort of the Country Joe and the Fish and the Grateful Dead. Simon was on the board of the festival, quite what his involvement was. I mean, I think he said somewhere it's basically keeping the battling musicians from Los Angeles and San Francisco apart. I don't think he particularly contributed to the success of the festival. And I don't think their performance really helped the trajectory at all. I mean, the Beach Boys famously declined to appear at Monterey, which set their career back about 5 years. I don't think it enhanced Simon and Garfunkel's career particularly.
Right. They aren't performances that people talk about famously the way they do of The Who or Hendrix.
I think they appeared on the Friday night and very politely received, and then Hendrix's flaming performance and The Who's sort of, you know, Apocalypse Now was the one that people remember.
Well, let's move to bookends then. What are leaps of creativity that you can point to in this presentation?
Well, Bookends, I think, is probably the best Simon and Garfunkel album. But then again, it's a bit misleading because this is for older listeners. The second side of the album, the old side two of the vinyl album, is just singles and B-sides that were around. I mean, he didn't have enough material. Poor Simon didn't have enough material for an entire new album. But the really significant part of the Bookends album is the old side one, beginning with the Bookends theme and concluding with that, you know, and going through it's life to death. I mean, it's that youthful exuberance on Save the Life of My Child. It's a sort of slightly growing up and traveling and seeing the country on America. It's the marriage breakup on Overs. It's the voices of old people, and then it's old friends sitting like a bookends on a park bench. So it's life to death, and it works, I think, incredibly well. You've got that song Sweet. You've also got one of the very, very first examples of sampling. And if you listen carefully on Save the Life of My Child, you'll hear Simon and Garfunkel singing Sounds of Silence buried in the mix. That was one of the first times that anybody had ever done that. As a production, it's an incredible piece of work. And I mean, even the second side, I mean, even Faking It and Punky's Dilemma and Mrs. Robinson, I mean, they're good, substantial songs. But the songs that make up the Bookend Suite, and particularly America, I think, are really substantial pieces of work. Mm-hmm.
I want to be sensitive to your time, I think I'd said something in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 minutes top. So let me just pick a couple of other things, because I'm not going to be able to walk you through every step here that
no,
I'd like.
No, we're sort of only on the foothills at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, but I was interested in your essay in the book that did go into some depth comparing Simon to Dylan, or talking about, you know, what is significantly different about the two and the way they work and the way they write. You know, that it's not really those who say, well, there's Paul Simon, there's Bob Dylan, they're both folk singers with guitars, miss what's different about Paul Simon. I wonder if you'd recant or reflect on that a little bit.
Well, the comparison between Bob Dylan and Paul Simon came about very early on. Dylan began as a folk singer and within a couple of years had moved off the map, really. But anyone who picked up an acoustic guitar and who sang songs that had any lyrical merit was immediately compared to Bob Dylan, and that's something Simon found happened very quickly to him, which I think is one of the reasons why he came to live in the UK in the mid-60s. But I think what's intriguing in comparing the two men's work, I mean, the way they work is so different. I mean, Dylan, just the very few examples of original Bob Dylan lyrics that have surfaced, either at auction or on fan sites or whatever, it's pretty much what you hear on the record is pretty much straight off. I mean, it's the first draft. I mean, there's very, very little revision in Dylan's classic work of the 60s. Whereas with Paul Simon, when you've seen him interviewed or talking about the creative process, it's page after page of yellow legal pads, and he's really... It's the old thing about every bit of stone has got a sculptor inside it, and you chip away at it until you find it. And I think that's very true of Simon. It's a painstaking process for him. My favourite story about the Dylan-Simon comparison, which Paul Simon has later denied, but it shouldn't let the truth get in the way of a good story, is that the first time he met Dylan, somebody introduced him, and he went round to Dylan's apartment. And when Dylan went out to get a coffee or do whatever Bob Dylan does. Paul Simon started rifling through his waste paper bin to try and pick up scraps of paper just to see how Dylan did it. He couldn't believe he could just churn this stuff out so quickly. And I think it's, as I say, if it isn't true, it should be, because Simon is notoriously painstaking when it comes to writing. And I think he himself wishes he could be a bit more liberated. And I think he envies that in Dylan, just that ability to commit to writing stuff that just stays around forever. He can just do it so spontaneously and so brilliantly and so effortlessly. And I think Simon finds it a real effort to actually fashion these songs. But on the other hand, the success of Paul Simon's material so eclipses Bob Dylan. You know, I would guess that Bridge Over Troubled Water alone has probably sold more copies than everything Bob Dylan's ever recorded on album. So, you know, there is a comparison, and there are the pros and the cons, but certainly financially Simon's the most successful. Creatively, well, you make your own mind up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you also point out that their studio styles are very different, that more often than not, Dylan tries to get in and out as quickly as possible, and it's quite...
Yeah, I mean, my favourite is, I think, when he's doing Blood on the Tracks. I mean, they're recording, I don't know, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, and he went to get a coffee and he wrote an extra verse coming back from the coffee machine. You know, he can't bear being in there, whereas I think Simon actually does quite enjoy it. Bridge Over Troubled Water, it was such a successful album for them. I mean, everybody goes through it if you're in that league. I mean, Pink Floyd, everyone has real difficulty following up these albums that are just so successful. And when Paul Simon's debut album came out in 1972, it was a lot of people in the UK were really pleased, because the opening track, Mother and Child Reunion, is a very strong reggae track. Now, Simon would have picked up on reggae or ska or bluebeat, as it was known, back in London in the mid-60s, when the West Indian communities used to play it a lot. So he'd have heard that over here. And they did try rather tentatively on Bridge Over Troubled Water to do a bit of reggae bluebeat on Why Don't You Write Me. But in Mother and Child Reunion, Simon went down to Kingston, Jamaica, and recorded with the reggae guys down there. So you've got a really good groove to it. And I think that's probably the outstanding track on Paul Simon. Although Duncan is a probably the most Simon and Garfunkel song on the album. And interestingly enough, when the Paul Simon album was re-released a couple of years ago with some bonus tracks, the most interesting thing was an alternative version of Duncan with all sorts of different lyrics, and it had a really different narrative to it. So I think there are a couple of really interesting songs from that album. I mean, then it's all still crazy. But, I mean, I think Graceland, I'd be very happy to talk about if you've got anything you want to ask about that.
Well, when you think about that, and I have to be honest, I haven't read your chapter on Graceland in there, but, you know, what made that moment in his creative process connect so well with a public that obviously was very enamored with what he had to offer?
Well, I think Graceland is an absolutely fascinating album on a number of levels. I think that, I mean, it's one of the great creative rebirths of popular music. I mean, I think the only comparable thing, I just finished a book on Tom Waits, and I think he came back, he had this career as a sort of barroom balladeer, was reborn on Swordfish Trombones. And I think Paul Simon had this image of being a sort of introspective bedsit bard, which Graceland just completely took him into a whole different league. I mean, I remember I went to I mean, his career after Paul Simon and the Rhyming Simon album and Still Crazy, I mean, it hadn't done, you know, he was comfortable, but I mean, albums like One Trick Pony and Hearts and Bones were not exciting audiences in the way that the Simon and Garfunkel stuff or the early solo stuff did. So he was really looking for an audience, and I mean, was pretty much written out of the picture. And I remember I went to a playback album of a playback of the Graceland album in 1986 in London, which he was at, and I think we were all expecting, you know, those sort of introspective Woody Allen New York type songs, and then to hear that The Boy in the Bubble and Graceland just coming out of those wardrobe-sized speakers was just unbelievable, because world music then Well, it didn't really exist. I mean, you know, there were those who were aware of the music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo and the music of the townships of South Africa. But this was the first time it really received global attention. And I think that's what makes it such an arresting record, is that it just sounded quite unlike anything else that was around at the time. I mean, the 80s pop scene was ghastly, and it just is one of those. It's one of the greatest albums of that decade, and I think one of the best albums in his career, because it took him back to his roots. What he heard in the music of the black townships of South Africa was what attracted him to popular music in the first place. It was doo-wop, it was R&B from New York in the 50s, and he made that connection with the township jive of South Africa in the 80s. And, of course, the thing with Graceland, I mean, the controversy, particularly in the UK, overshadowed the greatness of the record. I mean, a lot of it was a very political issue, and a lot of people picketed the shows he played at the Albert Hall in 87 because they believed he'd broken the cultural boycott. In fact, he hadn't. I mean, he'd gone to South Africa to record and had not breached the cultural boycott. He turned down seven-figure sums to appear at Sun City in South Africa, which he felt would have supported the apartheid regime. And what he felt he was doing on Graceland was bringing the music of South Africa to the world, which I genuinely believe he did. And I think his intentions were entirely honourable on that record.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's something about his lyrical approach that I think he said in interviews seemed to change around Hearts and Bones that I can hear, you know, there's like more conversational style, there's more humor. Is that something that you would note as well?
I think Paul Simon's lyrical style has changed over the years. I mean, he's never been the easiest lyricist to understand. He's never really explained the lyrics, which I suppose is one reason why the music endures. I mean, it is there are many levels to it. But I think he's become more conversational, yet more opaque. I mean, it's very difficult to find out exactly what a Paul Simon song is about. And he will talk about it. He's one of the most articulate musicians talking about his own music. But I think he's got, the way he writes has changed so much. I mean, it used to be, you know, he'd sit there with a guitar and fashion songs around the guitar. Now it's almost like he'll go into the studio and start a groove and just see what comes out of that, and then write the melody later. Then the lyrics might go on top of it. I don't think he knows where it comes from. I mean, I think he's as baffled as everyone about the creative process. I remember he said in an interview once that he was just about to get into the shower, and the phrase "still crazy after all these years" just literally popped into his mind. And he forsook his shower briefly, jotted the title down, and then went back to it. You know, so I think he's as baffled as anyone about where this stuff comes from.
Well, Patrick Humphreys, you've been more than gracious with your time, and it's just a joy to talk with you. It's fun, and I thank you for your insight and your research.
Thank you. It was it's fun. I'm sorry we can't. I mean, I think we'd still be here tomorrow at this rate if we get through every aspect of his career. But I think you've got enough certainly to be going on with.